Hi, this is David Rothberg. I'm here with Albert Freeberg. Good morning, Albert. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I apologize to all the investors. Welcome to you all. I apologize for the delay. We had a technical problem here. It needs to be resolved. I hope everyone can hear us okay. Today is the 27th of July, 2011. I'll remind everyone that after the call takes place, we will be posting the call in the form of an MP3 file on our website. A quick issue of housekeeping, the format for the call, we tried to change a bit, and we encourage all listeners to send us their questions. Our esteemed colleague, Edwin Rott, is on summer vacation this week, so you can send them directly to me. My email address is drothberg, R-O-T-H-B-E-R-G, at niagaracapital.ca. drothberg@niagaracapital.ca. Let's get to business. Al, the first question that I have is a bit of an abrupt one. It's from a long-time investor. He asks the question that, or he makes the comment saying that he's concerned about the increasingly wide swings of the global macro fund. What is this increased volatility due to, and do you find it acceptable, and do you want to address it or change it? Something that this represents a style swing in the management.
Well, I do think that it's been a little bit more volatile, certainly on a weekly basis, maybe not so much on a daily basis, because we have checked it against indices, stock indices, and found that it's not more any more volatile than stock indices. But maybe on a weekly basis and over longer periods of time, it is a little bit more volatile. There's no doubt that markets have become more volatile in that sense. Markets change their minds continuously. One day we're off risk, or 1 week we're off risk, another day we're on risk, or another week we're on risk. And there's been a lot of uncertainty that is causing this, the European situation, the American situation with the debt ceiling. So I believe that's part and parcel of the new environment. The new financial environment that we're in is one that's clearly more volatile. It is also true that we have taken on more leverage in the past few months, substantially more leverage than we have had in recent years. A good part of that leverage is what we call balance trades or semi-balance trades or hedge trades, where we put on a position and then put something else against it. And so we actually are using up quite a bit of capital, but it not necessarily increases our risk by that factor. But there's no question that there is more volatility, and if you're asking me if I'm more or less comfortable, the answer is I am just as comfortable, but a heck of a lot more frustrated than I used to be.
It's been a brutal trading environment. I just read yesterday that, not entirely because of it, but George Soros has retired after a four-decade career as a hedge fund manager, and this falls hot in the heels of his converting 75% of the assets that he had under management into cash. I haven't seen a single fund this year that seems to be making money, or even an index, even an ETF that's ahead, if not just marginally. Do you have any ideas of why that is?
Probably is that nature of the market that we talked about, which is a market that's very erratic, where there haven't been some clear trends to follow. And as you know, most hedge funds, or a great majority of hedge funds, are good at pressing trends. Yet, having said that, we have seen, at least in our own portfolio, a steady improvement since early January. I'd say of the nature of three steps up and two steps down. but it's been improving. So we think that there is an underlying, very subtle underlying trend behind this market, but it's pretty subtle, and you need a microscope almost to look at it. But I'd say that that's the reason why majority of hedge funds have not done well this year.
Does it relate to the dollar?
I don't think it relates to the dollar. I think the dollar relates to the environment, the dollar movements, as well as the commodity movements, as well as fixed income markets and equity markets. All these are all dependent today on views, on general views, very general views. There's very little micro views here, and these views are erratic because, you know, one day, as I said, people would want to take more risk, and another day they want to take off risk completely. So the dollar is really part of that same uncertainty. It's another asset.
When you say that there's a trend that you sense is subtle, it needs to be viewed, if it's viewable at all, via a microscope, where are you looking? Can you be a little bit more specific?
I think that the overall trend that we're seeing since the beginning of the year is one in which we have a clear deceleration in economic activity around the world. Emerging markets have begun this long-awaited process of tightening to fight inflation, and so they are slowing down significantly, but not enough yet to take care of the inflationary problems. Europe is really overwhelmed by this fiscal austerity and losing ground steadily in terms of economic activity. The U.S. having completed the stimulus, having gone through the stimulus package and having gone through QE2, finds itself sort of in a soft spot, and more than just a soft spot, where there's very little outside stimulus, and where consumers are fighting now, or where consumers are finding that their real incomes have been shrinking, and that's a problem. And so they've had to deleverage at the same time as their real incomes have been shrinking, and that's difficult to do. The only bright spot in the U.S., at least, has been the corporate sector, which has had very good productivity and good profits. But that, too, there's only a limit to what productivity can do if top line doesn't grow. And we see here top line continuing to slow down and perhaps even become negative. So the big picture is that the world is slowing down. It's slowing down dangerously, that we may be entering a period of actual recession, a global recession. All the forces, all the major forces today coincide in that direction. And that will be accompanied by disorderly defaults, disorderly markets. And so that's the big picture. That's the greater picture. But it is punctured from time to time by official pronouncements of optimism by presidents and heads of central banks and ministers all making the right noises, coming up with plans and programs and other things of that sort. So that's why the markets have become so erratic. There's been a tremendous amount of official intervention, if not intervention, but verbal intervention. And that is obscuring somehow the underlying trend.
Al, I just got an email from one of our listeners saying that the volume is very difficult to hear. Can I ask you please to speak a little more directly into the microphone?
David, I'm doing that. I'm speaking directly to the phone, and I find that your voice is also sort of very low. But okay, yeah, I'm going to try. I hope that it's better now.
Thank you. I'll do the same. I apologize to listeners who are having trouble. I hope that this is better. Okay, your original, macro view is certainly a gloomy one. Can we get a little bit more specific and talk about some of the particular tradables that we have in the portfolio now? You mentioned in the in your quarterly report that you have a generally bullish view on the dollar, and there are a great many listeners who are especially interested in your views on the dollar. Could you elaborate a little bit on those, please?
Well, no. I think that if you compare the U.S. today, and again, foreign exchange rates are relative assets, right? They're relative values. If you compare the U.S. position today with the rest of the world, the U.S. is in probably the best single position. They have had a fairly low currency. The currency has been depreciating for many years. They had a very solid corporate sector. They have a banking system that's extremely liquid and in position to commence a upward credit cycle. They have some very good fiscal measures that have taken in states of the United States where many of them are regaining fiscal sanity. We have a very good fight in Washington today. I think that it's a healthy fight and it's a good fight. It's both ideologically a good fight, and it's also brings up to the fore the real issues today, and I think it's something that will eventually produce results. So the U.S. is in a good position to benefit in the next few years relative to the rest of the world. So our feeling is that the U.S. will do better, the U.S. dollar will do better in coming years. Or at coming years, anyway, compared to the rest of the world. But that is not necessarily our biggest bet, but it's clearly one of the important parts of the portfolio.
Yeah, I don't know if the questions from our audience themselves speak to a certain consensus, but it's remarkable how many people want to hear your views on the dollar. They want to know, they're anxious about the Canadian dollar, of course, but people are also very interested to know your views on the euro and on the Australian dollar. We have several questions about your views on the Australian dollar. You wrote about Australia in the quarterly report. Do you think you could, while we're speaking about currencies, elaborate a little bit on those?
Well, Europe is Europe, and everybody knows the European problem. And as long as we're able to, as long as the politicians have been able to push the problem aside, or push the can down the road, like they say, the euro is well maintained and well held and well bid. No doubt, there's been a tremendous amount of short positions in the euro, and that's supporting the market. I don't see the euro doing well against the dollar over the next, say, the next 12, 18 months. But with one exception, if the euro breaks up and we're left in the euro, we're left with the stronger partners, with Germany, with Netherlands, with Austria, with Finland. If we're left with those countries, then the euro should do substantially better. But as long as it's linked to the weaker members of euro, the euro is unlikely to go very far. The Aussie is no different than the other commodity currencies, actually Canadian, Brazilian, real, Aussie, the Kiwi, South African, all these currencies, what we call the commodity currencies, are all reacting to strong commodity prices. They've been strong till now anyway. And very, very powerful terms of trade, favorable terms of trade for these countries. My feeling is that we've probably seen the peak in commodity prices, and especially something like oil, and that these currencies are very, very overvalued at this moment, and we are going to see a very substantial depreciation in commodity currencies. Problem is to finding the right time or timing for it. We tried, for instance, going short the Aussie and then had to cover it a week later because it kept going higher. It's, you know, so we have to manage our risk. But to us, commodity currencies, I mean, to me, commodity currencies are really a last year's game. And they're getting extremely likely to come down quite a bit. We think that in the next 18 months it could go down anywhere between 10 and 25%.
Would you rank the Canadian dollar in that category?
Yeah. I think the Canadian dollar is not as excessively overvalued as they are, but it should not surprise me. It would not surprise me if we see it down to the low 90s over the next 18 months. Again, we don't have a position in the Canadian dollar. It's not something that I'm interested in trading. I did, as they say, try temporarily the Aussie because I thought of all the commodity currencies is the one that's probably most excessively overvalued alongside the Brazilian real. And it's not a position that we find that we have enough conviction and for now to trade it. And that the conviction has to do with timing. But, you know, the commodities, on the other hand, is an area where we have a little bit more conviction. And by the way, when I speak commodities, I want to take gold out of that equation. I've always did. I've never considered gold a commodity. So other than gold, in my view is that commodities have seen their highs and are heading lower in this next phase of global economic phase.
Can you speak just briefly about gold?
Well, yeah, gold remains a safe haven, and it's been recognized so, and it's becoming more widely understood that way. A lot of the earlier skepticism of years past have been vanishing, and that always happens when something goes up in price. If it goes up in price long enough, you'll convince even the greatest skeptic. We still have that overhang, or that potential, let's call it, that potential demand of central banks. They, in my view, eventually central banks will remonetize their reserves, and there's potentially a very large bid as a result of that. So still in the future, the Chinas and Indias and Brazils of the world will be adding to their gold reserves. And that should make the price go higher. That's really the main our main view on gold. And it's only now beginning to reach the level that 5 years ago we forecast at the time, given the reserves numbers at the time we made a forecast that gold would reach $1,600. That's in 2005 or 2006 we said that. And it's now beginning to get to that level. And of course, since then, foreign exchange reserves, central bank reserves have exploded. So if we were to do the calculation again, we'd probably get to, I don't know, $2,500, $3,000 easily.
I can imagine a great many listeners salivating at the prospect. Let's move on.
I don't think there's anything to salivate on here.
Here's a question from a colleague. I'll quote it to you. Much of your outlook, as outlined in your quarterly letter, is predicated on the imminent breakup of the Eurozone. Of course, there's another possible end to this story. That would be stronger fiscal union would save the Eurozone, at least for the time being. What specific events would indicate to you that your expectation is incorrect, and what type of trades would these occurrences trigger?
Well, that's a complicated question. Wait a second. It's got a lot of parts.
You want me to repeat it to you?
Okay, let me start if I get it. We're not necessarily saying that the Eurozone would break up. We're saying that there's going to be some inevitable defaults, and I think that that's sort of widely understood now, that there has to be some defaults. And these defaulting countries can stay in the Eurozone, there's mechanisms for them to stay. There are countries that have not acceded yet to the Euro, for instance, some of the Baltic countries, but yet they are in the Eurozone under a different type of membership. And I think we can do the same thing with Greece and Portugal, for example. So we're not necessarily betting that the Eurozone would break up. We're saying that their debts are impossible for them to bear, and there's going to be a sudden bolt out of this agreement. On the surface, it looks good. On the surface, it looks that the creditors are trying very hard, and that they are. And that they are making some concessions, that they're saying that they're going to lower rates to them. Yes, they are trying hard because they have an enormous amount of money invested in that process. It's the old story that a guy who owes $1 million can't sleep at night, but if he owes $100 million, the bank can't sleep at night. And I think that the creditors, France, Germany, and so on, can't sleep at night because they have a lot of money outstanding. And so they are trying whatever way possible to get these countries to service the debt. I don't think it's possible. It's just absolutely not possible. Nor is it possible for them to stay within the euro itself. They will need some kind of a flexibility, a currency flexibility. And some of these countries will probably need a 25 to 35% devaluation. So however we arrive at that, and that's something that we can't really bet on, but if I would have to bet, I would say that that's pretty certain. They will unhinge from the euro because the euro is just too expensive for them. So, it's still possible to maintain, if it's done intelligently, still impossible to maintain these countries inside of the eurozone. Now, what the problem is that the way the creditors want to do it, is endangering the strongest members of the euro. For the creditors to actually continue to underwrite the financing needs of Greece and Portugal and Spain and possibly Italy and maybe Ireland, for them to continue to underwrite them, it means that they will now endanger their own credit standing. And the closer the cooperation, the closer we move to what's called a euro bond, and in essence it's just a jargon, but it just means Germany, practically Germany. Germany borrows money and the Chinese would be happy to lend money to Germany. And then Germany goes and lends the money to these people. The closer we get to that, the more difficult it becomes for some of the strongest members. It could actually drag them down. And that's the reason, for example, that we liquidated our Bund position, long 10-year German bond, because we felt that it was becoming dangerous. The credit position was unstable, and in fact, we went even further now and purchased options, betting on their downside, in order to protect our CDS bets, and I was in order to protect the credit default bets on some of the other countries. So we reasoned that if Spain and Portugal, for example, don't default, it's only because Germany has bailed them out. And if Germany has bailed them out, then Bunds would go down, and so we'd make money there and we'd lose money on the CDS. So that's the type of hedge position I was referring to earlier. At any rate, but it, the idea being that these creditors are very deep, very, very deep into their debtors. And is there a way out? As I say, there are ways out, but they have to be much more realistic than they are today. It's no good for the big creditors to continue doing what they're doing. I think they have to bite the bullet. I think what they should do is concentrate on their banking system, and they should allow the periphery to move out of the Class A membership of the Eurozone, give them more flexibility, allow them to default, but at the same time strengthen their banks, which, by the way, will lead us to the next point, which is our position in banks. We think that the European banks are in great danger, almost all of them. It's not only their exposure to governments in the periphery, which, as we know, is problematic, but they have an enormous exposure to put private sector in the periphery. And so, in our view, European banks are doomed to grow a lot lower. And no matter what governments will do, and what they should be doing, is recapitalizing these banks, forcing them to issue more and more shares, more capital, strengthening them. And, of course, the process of doing that will dilute the equity significantly. So, no matter what, we think European banks are headed a great deal lower. So that's in a nutshell sort of the European picture.
How have you positioned the portfolio to capture this bearish view you have on European banks?
We are short, I believe, 5 European banks. Gained a little bit of leverage by doing it via swap, a bank swap, but we, in essence, we're short 5 banks. And that's one area that we short Europe, European banks. We also short American banks. We think the American banks will get they're in much better shape, I must say, much better shape capital-wise than European brethren, but there will be some effect on them too. We, in addition to that, we are, by the way, short banks in Australia, where we think that a credit cycle is coming to an end, where a housing cycle is coming to an end, where banks are going to be taking some very large losses on their loans. And so there we, too, focused on being short banks.
Let's shift just briefly to the public sector. You own protection on Spain and a number of European countries. And I think that the last questioner wants to know if you would change that view, or what in the what political event would alter your view so that you take that protection off.
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't have a position in credit default in Greece, example, because we think that it's already a very high risk. It's extremely expensive to bet against Greece. We have a very little exposure in Portugal, and we're about to be cashing out on those and taking some profit. Where we built a bigger position in Europe was in Spain and in Italy, primarily Spain, and it was done because the cost to do the Spanish bet was not high. You know, at the time that we did it was around the 200 basis points over Germany, maybe 250 points, which is not very expensive. And it's moving in the right direction. What is going to change our mind is if we see, for example, right now, the last agreement made in Europe, which is still sort of hazy and it's not well formed yet, but it moved in the direction of a euro bond, in that they want to create, they want to take that entity that they created. I forget now the name. It has a sigla, ESF or something, and they want to take that entity. What's that?
I can't help you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. But they want to take that entity that actually did the bailout or that did the lending to Greece. They want to take that entity and they want to strengthen it. And by strengthening means they want to eventually give it more money and give it more powers and allow it to buy even bonds, to buy government debt in the secondary market. It's moving slowly in the direction of a euro bond. Because it needs money, and it needs a lot of money. And of course, the other members of Euro, for example, Italy and Spain are members of that, but if they're going to be helped, they cannot guarantee that. So the guarantees will fall almost exclusively on Germany, Netherlands, France, and it gets larger and larger, so they have to take on more and more responsibility in these countries. So if we see that the movement takes a momentum in that, if we see that the Constitutional Court in Germany, which is now hearing a case against the bailout, allows the Bundestag to allows the German government to do what they're doing, if we see that the German parliament endorses this move, this latest move, and we see that we're moving closer to a Eurobond, to a national bond, to the common market will have just one bond, one let's say almost one fiscal agent, almost one government for that purpose. If we see that, obviously our CDS bet will sour, and we'll probably be liquidating it, and we will probably be increasing our short position in banks, because it means that they'll be getting deeper and deeper into the mud. So, and probably deeper, and probably increasing a short position in bonds, because that means they're going to get deeper into the mud. So it's a seesaw. It's a seesaw. We're now watching, we're waiting, we're looking and seeing where is this commitment going. If the commitment gets stronger over the next 2-3 months, probably by the end of September, we'll know. We'll be out of the CDS and be more involved in the other area.
Before we leave Europe behind and move towards the end of the call by talking about stocks, let me just ask you about, we have one investor who wants to talk about Italian bonds. Italian bonds have sold off an awful lot beginning about 3 weeks ago. Do you think that this route can continue?
That's the point.
Every basis point rise imperils more and more economic activity and turns into a vicious cycle that many have predicted would eventually occur in Japan.
David, this is exactly what we did. I mean, we bought CDS in Italy. We did exactly that bet. And it's true. Interest rates in Italy have risen, and the CDS have shown that rise. And it's no more than an aspect of something that we've been talking for the last 10 minutes or 15 minutes. These countries, unless they are given more leeway, unless they can get out of the euro straitjacket, will at some point default, no matter what. And so that means higher rates, of course.
Okay. Thank you. Let's move over. Let's talk a little bit about the stocks, the equity positions that you have in the equity hedge pocket, which has, in general, improved quite a bit over its performance last year after you reduced the number of positions that you held, and also some larger trades that you have outside of the equity hedge pocket in Australia, which we've touched on briefly, and also in the banking sector in the United States.
Right. Well, let me just say this: the most interesting position that we have, really, in the equity side, in my view, the most interesting position we have in the equity side, other than what we have in our equity positions, in equity hedge position, which is really some longs and some shorts. We're long Google, we're happy to say, which is kind of a new thing for us. But anyway, the most interesting equity position that we have, without any doubt, is Bank of Ireland. It has been recapitalized. It's become a new bank, a strong bank, a bank with very little or almost no bad assets, probably the soundest bank in all of Europe. If anybody's going to make it, it's Bank of Ireland. If anybody's going to make it, it's Bank of Ireland. So, and we have now a substantial position there. I'm tempted every single day to increase the position, but it represents at least 5% of the fund. Should Europe collapse, we'll probably make a lot of money in some of our short bets in Europe. If Europe muddles through, we're going to make a lot of money in the Bank of Ireland. So that's the most exciting one of the positions that we have on the equity side, I would say. We are, as I said before, we are short Australian banks pretty heavily, and I think that we're happy about that. We also short the Indian stock market, which we think is one of the markets that gone too far, and if the Indian economy now is going through a very, very severe bout of inflation, the Bank of India has maintained interest rates that are much too low. I've been saying this for a year now. They're not raising them fast enough. They're still not raising them fast enough. They raised it last night by half of the 50 basis points. It's still not high enough. They are behind inflation rate. Clearly, Indian equities are going lower. Same thing with Brazil. We're very heavily short Brazil. Probably our single largest exposure country-wise is Brazil. An unsustainable credit cycle there. It's going to explode. And so we are very, very happy with those positions. We think there's a lot of money to be made there, and they've been moving in that direction. Again, as I said from the beginning of the conversation, since January, these things have been moving slowly in that direction. They get obscured by all kinds of events that happen around them, but slowly and inevitably and inexorably, they are moving in the direction that we want them to move, in the direction that they should be moving.
When you're speaking about inexorability, what you're speaking of are the basic economic forces, and if I understand you right, what interrupts those forces is the noise of government policies, both verbal and fiscal. Would that be right?
Exactly. Silly statements like President Obama speaking about the peace or things like that. So those are silly things, you know. And we get these pronouncements from every single minister in Europe. Silly statements, but the silly statements are interrupt some of the forces temporarily only. Some of the forces that are happening. The main economic force is you can't wish away debt. You can't blow it away. You can't make it disappear. There's only one way to do it. Either you pay it back or you default. And as the debt gets larger and larger, you can't pay it back. So the next step in global economics, no matter what presidents and ministers say, is default. And we're going to see a lot of default. But if we don't, in those countries or in those states or in those corporations that you don't see default, it is because they have tightened their belts. And they're going through a very, very austere period, which, again, doesn't bode well for equities. So either way, I think that we're coming into a very difficult period ahead, and where we either default because you just can't pay those things back, they're too large, the debt is too large, or if you want to pay back, then you're going to have to tighten your belt significantly. So that's really in a nutshell the picture. There's no way out. You can't wish it away. You can't speak nicely about it.
Interrupting you there, I thought that I would give you the opportunity if you wanted to add your voice to a prediction about the default that's being debated now in Washington.
Well, I think it's a healthy. I happen to think it's a very healthy debate. I had to laugh when I saw the Chinese scholar, very high up in the government there, who was saying that this shows the ugliest and darkest aspect of capitalism. I really had to laugh because you know in China nobody knows anything, nobody knows what's going on, and there's debt. Trillions of debt, of the dollars of debt that are going bad now, and nobody knows about it. In the U.S., I think we have a very good debate. It's true that there's some posturing going on, no doubt. It's political, and there is an election coming out next year. But we have two visions. We have a vision where Democrats believe that as the population ages, the government has to become a little bit more of a partner in the economy, and therefore they want to see government participation in the economy increase, and they're willing to see it increase to maybe 22% of GDP, maybe 23% of GDP, and in order to do that, they have to raise taxes. The Republicans have a different view. They want to go back to a period of time when the government was smaller and where the American economy could be more vibrant and can do what it used to do. They want to get away from the social capitalism of Europe. And so they want to reduce government intervention, and they say, look, the only way to do that is by starving the beast. That's Milton Friedman's famous line. Cut taxes, you'll starve the beast. The government needs food, so just cut the taxes. I think it's a very nice, very healthy debate. I don't think that the debt ceiling discussion now is going to produce anything significant. I think all it does now is it sets the tone. It sets the tone for this coming year, sets the tone for the coming 2, 3, 4 years. And it sets the tone in a very, very clear way. What do we want in the future? What do we want for a government in the future? And it's symbolic, and it's important, and we know that it's not going to be a default. You can see the bond market is barely moving. The bond market doesn't believe there will be a default. If there is a technical default, which means at least for 4 weeks or something, the government doesn't pay, that doesn't mean much. But this is good for bondholders. Right? This is good for bondholders. This is not a bad thing for bondholders. So it just sets the stage, and I think that's important. It sets the stage.
No major investment, and let's wind it up with this last question. No major investment ramifications of the results, however they turn out?
As a trader, I would say that once the debt ceiling is lifted, the relief rally will be very short-lived. And I think that the markets are waiting for that, to have that relief rally, and after that, they're heading lower. I believe that they're heading lower because they have to face a slower economy, and they have to face all the consequences of this debt restructuring, or reprofiling, or realignment, whatever you call it. So markets are waiting for this. Hopefully there'll be a solution sometime next week, maybe the end of next week. And after the market will celebrate for about an hour or two, and promptly thereafter we should be heading lower.
Okay. Al, thank you very much for your time this morning. We try and keep the calls to about 45 minutes, and we've reached our limit. Once again, I apologize to all listeners for any technical issues that happened at the beginning of the call. If you have any questions that you want to ask subsequent to the call, again, please email them to me, drockberg@niagaracapital.ca. And again, a quick reminder that we'll be posting the call in the form of an MP3 file, which we'll notify you of on our website. Again, thank you very much, Albert, and we wish you a good trading third quarter.
Okay, David, thanks. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, all. Thank you.